This is the NBC Sunday Night News, brought to you by Exxon.
Tonight, January 28th, reported by Garrick Utley with David Brinkley's Journal.
Good evening. On the first day of the ceasefire in South Vietnam, but it was not a day of peace. It was a day of more fighting and political disputes. In this country, it was the day a few American families learned that their relatives, missing in action, will be coming home. And one wife learned that her husband was the last American to die in the Vietnam War. The official ceasefire in Vietnam is now a day old. A day old, but not perfect. There is still heavy fighting around Saigon, and no sooner had the first peacekeeping forces arrived in Saigon than there were difficulties. 10 Viet Cong representatives flew in from Bangkok, but refused to get off their plane. They would not sign customs and immigration forms. To do so, they said, would have implied recognition of the Saigon government. So there they sit tonight in their airplane. Neither the North Vietnamese nor the Viet Cong recognized the Tu government, but North Vietnamese representatives who arrived in Saigon today made no fuss. They signed the forms and entered the city. And so did one Viet Cong official traveling with them. So the ceasefire has already seen its first political skirmishes. There will certainly be others, part of the peace in Vietnam. Peace that came at 8 this morning, Saigon time. Steve Delaney reports.
The ceasefire came to Saigon with bells ringing and sirens blowing as ordered by President Tu. He also asked the people to stop what they were doing for 1 minute at 8 o'clock, but most of them did not unless Tu's police flagged them down in the streets. Vietnam has had ceasefires before, and those did not produce peace. So nobody got excited about this one. There was no public outburst of emotion. While the people seemed to welcome the end of the shooting, most of them believe the ceasefire will produce a limbo condition somewhere between peace and war. And while the bells were ringing, President Tu was on television, telling his people this is not peace, just a ceasefire, and now is the time to be more resolute than ever. In a country which has been at war for so many years, peace is an elusive ideal. Steve Delaney, NBC News, Saigon.
In some areas of South Vietnam, mostly north and northwest of Saigon, the ceasefire came and went with no end to the fighting. Enemy troops reportedly have captured 66 hamlets in the provinces around Saigon since the ceasefire started. Four major highways leading into Saigon have been cut by the enemy. American military analysts say the fighting was expected and that Saigon's hold on the countryside is not seriously threatened. Threatened or not, there is fighting, and here's a report from Ron Nessie.
Dawn in Vietnam on the morning of peace, 27 minutes before the ceasefire. The district military headquarters in the town of Cu Chi, 13 minutes before the ceasefire. The troops waiting for the end of their long war. Nearby, Vietnamese tended the graves of their ancestors, a traditional ceremony just before Tet. Nearly every house and shop in this area flew a South Vietnamese flag to show loyalty to President Tu's government and opposition to the Viet Cong. 8 o'clock, the moment of peace. At the little Catholic church in Cu Chi, the mass was interrupted so the bell could be rung in celebration. Then something went wrong. Near the town of Trang Bang, 30 miles northwest of Saigon, South Vietnamese tanks, armored cars, and troops moved up to a section of Highway 1 and a nearby village, which the Viet Cong had occupied just before the ceasefire. 1 hour and 17 minutes after the ceasefire, a battle erupted. It was not clear which side fired first, the South Vietnamese trying to recapture territory or the Viet Cong trying to hold on to territory. No international inspection team was around to determine which side violated the ceasefire. The battle went on most of the day, on what was supposed to be the first day of peace. Ron Nessen, NBC News, along Highway 1 near Trang Bang.
Lieutenant Colonel William Nolde, 43, of Mount Pleasant, Michigan, is officially the last American killed in Vietnam before the ceasefire. He was an American advisor with the South Vietnamese, and he died in an enemy artillery barrage at An Lac, 60 miles north of Saigon. His widows today said, "I'm not bitter. He believed in what he was doing. Maybe people we know will be grateful for our country and the way we live."
Lieutenant Colonel Nolde, his wife, and their five children have lived here in this house in Mount Pleasant for the past 5 years, but he wasn't here very much. The last time he was home, he painted the barn, but before he was able to finish it, he was transferred to Vietnam. His neighbors said he was active in the community when he was here, and a close friend and neighbor, Frank Powell, said Nolde was the kind of man you could depend on when you needed help. Did he ever talk to you about Vietnam?
Oh, he said there was dangers there, but he wasn't afraid. He made one remark. He said, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away," and he chuckled when he said it. And he had assignments, I know, all over the world. He was in Italy for quite a period of time. And at Christmas time, why, he didn't know whether to be home or not. He said, "Well, for good neighbor and friends, why, send us a wood-carved rosary as we keep it quite a keepsake."
What about his family? How did his wife take the news?
She called us right after she got the news, and she was, very deeply hurt, I'm sure.
Lieutenant Colonel William Nolde's wife and five children are not here now. They've gone north to be with her parents. But they'll be back here in Mount Pleasant later this week when the colonel's body is returned and the funeral is held for the last man to die in Vietnam before the ceasefire. Lou Davis, NBC News, Mount Pleasant, Michigan.
The Pentagon said today that the North Vietnamese list of prisoners of war includes 555 names, but that it is incomplete, that it does not include the names of six servicemen known to have been captured in Laos. The largest organization of families of prisoners and men missing in action went even further. In addition to the six men questioned by the Pentagon, the organization complained there has been no word on six men thought to be in China, and 311 men, they said, are missing in Laos. John Cochran has a report.
American warplanes are continuing to bomb Laos. The families were asked whether they are afraid the accounting of prisoners and missing in Laos may be delayed. The wife of a missing pilot answered.
Regardless of any type of military action in Laos, the agreement states that men detained in Laos will be released within the next 60-day period by North Vietnam in Hanoi. And at this particular time, we had anticipated, and perhaps it was just our anticipation, that we would receive such a list. And many families are waiting for this information, and it has not come forth.
The families are also concerned that at least 15 men believed to be captured in North Vietnam are not listed as prisoners by Hanoi.
Lieutenant Ronald Dodge is a good example. He was shot down over Hanoi on May 17, 1967. In September of that year, Paris Match magazine carried a full-page photograph of him taken by a Dutch photographer in Hanoi. Later, our government obtained a movie also identifying Lieutenant Dodge as a prisoner. Therefore, there can be no doubt about the fact that he was captured.
The families also want North Vietnam to provide proof of the deaths of any men who Hanoi claims died in POW camps. John Cochran, NBC News, Washington.
And none of that alters the fact that prisoners known to be alive will be coming home soon. That some men missing in action may be found, that some will not. The North Vietnamese have yet to render an accounting of the missing. In the suburbs of Chicago today, Bob Jameson talked with the mother of a missing man and with the mother of a prisoner.
The news that Air Force Colonel Ted Guy was alive reached his mother in her white bungalow in suburban Chicago early today. He had been shot down and taken prisoner in 1968, but until now, his mother was not certain he was still alive.
What was your immediate thought when the casualty officer told you that Ted's name was on the list?
Relief, because we thought he wasn't coming back.
Miss Guy, did you ever give up hope?
Yes. When after a period of 2 years, his mail was returned, his packages returned, we never heard from him. I didn't think there was much to hope for. I was afraid. I still am. Not that he's not coming back, I know he is, but what shape he will be when he gets here.
But here, in another Chicago suburb, another mother is still waiting to learn the fate of her missing son. The North Vietnamese list carried no mention of Marine Sergeant Timothy Bodden, missing since June 1967.
Bodden's mother received her call from military authorities last night. They could not tell her anything more than she already knew, that her son is still missing. And, says Mrs. Bodden, that's worse than learning that he is dead.
If Tim can't come back home again, it would be very, very comforting to know that maybe he didn't suffer too much. That if he were a prisoner for a short time, that they at least took care of his wounds. It would be very, very comforting to me to know that the men that he was with might possibly still be living. There are a thousand questions that go through your mind. You want to know where he might have been buried, if there was nothing left of him. He was a young boy when he went away, and he still is, in my mind, still that son.
The pain and uncertainty felt by the families of missing men will not go away soon. That pain, that uncertainty, are only two items on a long list afflicting this country as a result of the Indochina War. There is much to be done. And tonight, from Paris, David Brinkley's journal deals with that. David?
With the agonies of the Vietnam War behind us now, the leadership of the U.S. government can look forward to some other non-military settlements waiting to be made. There are a great many of them. Settlements or treatments of national ailments that we have often neglected while we were preoccupied with the war and its side effects. There are a great many of them. There is a ceasefire in the Middle East now, but it's a highly unreliable one, and some kind of settlement has to be made there before it explodes. Some kind of trade policy has to be developed before, among others, the Japanese accumulate all the money in the United States, taking over one market after another. And before the U.S. trade deficit gets completely out of hand, the interesting and promising new relationships between the United States and China and Russia can now be developed, and perhaps in new ways. Cuba maybe will be next. And, of course, the familiar list of domestic problems that Americans are irritated about and have been: crime, welfare, the outrageous tax system, pollution, diminishing supplies of energy, and the rest of that list. Not everyone has been fully aware of just how much American talent, time, money, and energy have been going into the war, fighting it, trying to end it, and protesting against it. Well, now, everyone who has been engaged in any of that, or all of that, will have time to do something more useful. There's a lot to do, and no reason now why we can't do it. Garrick?
With Vietnam behind us, Americans can start thinking about post-war United States. President Nixon already has. Tomorrow, he sends his first peacetime budget to Congress. President Nixon will send his annual budget message to Congress tomorrow. It will call for spending almost $269 billion in the fiscal year beginning July 1st. To hold the line on spending, the president plans to cut or eliminate many federal social programs. Today, anticipating some problems getting Congress to go along, the president appealed to the American people for support. Carl Stern reports from Washington.
In a hard-hitting speech delivered on radio only, President Nixon called on the American people to put pressure on Congress to support his plans for holding down federal spending. Members of Congress hear from the special interests, Mr. Nixon said. Let them hear from you. And he added, it's time to get big government off your back and out of your pockets. The president emphasized that his new budget of about $268.5 billion redeems his campaign pledge not to ask for a tax increase. But he warned that both higher taxes and higher inflation could occur unless Congress cooperates with his program to restrain federal spending. Mr. Nixon predicted that 1973 could be the most prosperous year in American history if excessive government spending does not interfere. The president also revealed that instead of following the normal procedure of sending a single State of the Union report to Congress, this year he will present it in a series of special messages on specific subjects, detailing his plans for cutting or eliminating such federal programs as aid for building hospitals, urban renewal, and aid for schools near federal facilities. A tight lid on federal spending is essential to Mr. Nixon's overall plan for fighting inflation. And this speech was the opening shot of what he has termed the battle of the budget. Carl Stern, NBC News, Washington.
The battle against inflation is familiar to many nations, but nowhere is it more intense than in Great Britain. There it was called a runaway inflation, and the measures taken by the government to stop it are severe. Still, inflation continues. George Montgomery reports on one very sensitive area.
Britain sizzle like steaks about soaring record high beef prices. The roast beef and the other beef of England have registered price increases of almost 50% since November. That's when the embarrassed government began a partial price and wage freeze. Some people said wryly that the crown jewels are now worth their weight in steak. People added that the butchers are keeping their beef in the safe and their money in the freezer. Steak is selling for the equivalent of $2.40 American per pound. Humble hamburger is 96 cents a pound. The normally posh pheasant costs no more than steak. There is speculation that the high beef prices result from a world beef shortage caused by rising affluence plus heavier British beef purchases by Britain's new common market partners. Ordinary beef eaters have their own views.
I would suspect that somebody is making a lot of money somewhere. Well, I think it's the farmers making all the money, really.
It's the old story. Shortage of supply, the price goes up. Simple as that. No one's getting anything out of it at all. No one's making any profit apart from normal profit.
Well, why is there a world shortage of beef?
Because the other countries are more prosperous. They're buying beef.
Eating it more than
they're eating it more. Simple as that.
Whatever the reason, it is almost impossible for the British working class person or even a middle class person to be able to afford to buy.
Meanwhile, fish prices are swimming upward. Britain's National Consumer Protection Council implies things are so bad that pretty soon the British won't be eating fish and chips, or French fries. Pretty soon the British will be eating chips and chips. George Montgomery, NBC News, London.
A series of tornadoes struck central Florida today. At least 18 people were injured and many buildings and homes were damaged. Worst hit was the city of Orlando, where 14 people were hurt and 300 left homeless. The volcano on the small island off Iceland continued to erupt today, destroying 40 more homes. Only 100 people remain on the island, mostly firemen trying to save homes and newsmen reporting on the devastation. Today at the island's aquarium, the caretaker freed seals and other sea animals to save them from the lava ashes and stones. In Northern Ireland today, thousands of Roman Catholics stood vigil and prayed on the streets of Londonderry. The observance marked the anniversary of the Bloody Sunday 1 year ago, when 13 Catholics were shot to death by British soldiers. This coming week is the first week of the ceasefire in South Vietnam, a test as to whether peace can work after so many years of war. For the parties involved in Vietnam, it will be a week of uncertainty, a week in which important precedents will be set, precedents that could determine whether peace will last. Here are reports from six of our correspondents on Vietnam and other stories we can expect in the week ahead.
In Vietnam this week, inspection teams from Canada, Poland, Hungary, and Indonesia will begin their job of trying to enforce the ceasefire. Fighting continued in some places immediately after the ceasefire was supposed to take effect, and there may be more fighting this week. Viet Cong and North Vietnamese officials will continue to arrive in Saigon to begin talks on a political settlement. Vice President Agnew is coming too, mostly as a gesture to show that the United States has not abandoned South Vietnam. And while all these people are arriving, the last American troops will be preparing to leave.
The first American prisoners of war from Hanoi are expected to arrive in the Philippines this week. There are reports from Washington indicating that there may be as many as 100 men in the group. Officers here said that within 10 days after arriving in the Philippines, the POWs will be home and reunited with their families.
On Tuesday night, Britain's Prime Minister, Edward Heath, and the Foreign Secretary, Sir Alec Douglas Hume, leave London by air for Washington and talks with President Nixon. Subjects for the talks include world trade, Southeast Asia following the Vietnam ceasefire, and Britain's Northern Ireland problem.
Representatives of a dozen European nations, plus the United States and Russia, hope to sit down in Vienna Wednesday to plan for talks on troop cuts in Europe. It'll be the start of preparations for the long-awaited conference on MBFR, or Mutual and Balanced Force Reductions.
In Fairfield, California, tomorrow, the court will hear a defense motion on a new trial for Juan Corona. Corona was found guilty of murdering 25 itinerant farm workers, but the defense claims tampering with the jury because a sheriff's matron discussed the case with one of the jurors, influencing her verdict.
In Canada, a dispute seems to be developing over the 1976 Summer Olympic Games scheduled here in Montreal. It is not unlike the dispute that killed the Winter Olympic Games in Colorado last year. Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau wants an ironclad guarantee that no tax money will be used to bail out the Games should they lose money. Without such a guarantee, he says, there may be no Games.
The public school system in Prince George's County, Maryland, is the 10th largest in the country, 162,000 students. Last July, a federal judge ruled the system wasn't fully desegregated, and tomorrow, after a six-month legal fight, a court-ordered busing plan affecting 33,000 students goes into effect.
The scenes are familiar. The emotion, the demonstration, the resistance to mass busing. This time it's Prince George's County, but there are allies from other busing fights.
Do not let busing come to Prince George's County in 2 weeks. I don't care how you stop it, but stop it.
There have been marches and motorcades to the state capitol and Congress to plead with officials trapped by the dilemma of busing.
Each and every one of us, as citizens of this great democracy, have a responsibility and an obligation to obey the law and to not in any way engage.
Busing is not new to the county. Nearly 75,000 students rode buses prior to the order. Another 12,000 will get on for the first time tomorrow. Many more will simply ride farther. Of the demonstration, there have been efforts to make the busing work. Youngsters have visited their new schools.
There is a lot to share. Who cares what we got to share?
In the high schools, where basketball teams will be broken up, where friends will be going to different schools, in the high schools, some are optimistic and some are tearful.
I really don't want to go. I just don't even, it's unreal. I can't even think about it.
I think it'll be a chance to meet new friends and new opportunities and people with different experiences. So I'm kind of looking forward to it, but with reservations.
Tomorrow morning, court-ordered busing comes to Prince George's County. Many parents angrily say they will keep their children home. It has all been said before.
I will stay here and fight for my children, and there will be a no damn bus.
Betty Walden, NBC News, Prince George's County, Maryland.
And that's the news on the Sunday evening. I'm Garrick Utley. Good night for NBC News.